between humans via mosquitoes when the Valley of T1 was uninhabited. Mosquitoes do not usually travel more than a few hundred yards in their entire lifetime, and the nearest humans potentially with malaria were many miles away. My Parisian friends made some phone calls and found a hospital a short metro ride away with an infectious disease lab that could test for malaria. I went that evening. They drew blood, and 90 minutes later, I had the results. No malaria. The doctor thought I had a common virus, unrelated to the Honduran trip, and assured me it was nothing to worry about. My fever had vanished even while I awaited my test results. 2 days later, I had fully recovered. Another month passed. The bug bites on my legs eventually faded away, along with the itching. But one bite did not go away. It was on my upper left arm, midway between elbow and shoulder, and it seemed to be getting redder and bigger. I didn't worry about it at first, because unlike the other bites, it didn't itch or bother me. In April, I had an outbreak of sores in my mouth and on my tongue, accompanied by another sudden fever. I went to the local emergency room in Santa Fe. The doctor who examined me thought it was herpes and gave me a prescription for an antiviral medication. I showed him the bug bite on my arm, which was getting uglier. He suggested I treat it with antibiotic ointment. That fever went away quickly, and the mouth sores disappeared soon after. The antibiotic cream, however, did nothing for my arm. Over the next few weeks, the bug bite expanded and developed a vile crust. I discussed it with Steve Elkins, and he said that Dave Yoder and Chris Fisher reported having similar bites that wouldn't heal. Steve suggested that we all photograph our bites and email the pictures around to compare. Dave, who lived in Rome, sent me a picture of his bite, which was on the back of his leg. It looked like mine, only worse. Dave was frustrated. He had gone to the ER in Rome 3 times, and the doctors kept diagnosing it as an infection and giving him antibiotics, which didn't work. "It doesn't look like a normal infection," he told me. "It looks like a miniature volcanic crater. It just won't heal." Dave began researching what he might have. "I try not to Google images of disease on the web," he said. "I've given myself 2 health scares caused by Googling. But this time I did, because I knew my doctors were wrong." The pictures that popped up made him think he might have the tropical disease leishmaniasis. He emailed pictures of his bug bite to 2 fellow photographers at National Geographic who had gotten leishmaniasis while on assignment. One was Joel Sartor, who contracted the disease while shooting in the Bolivian rainforest and who almost lost his leg as a result. Both photographers told Dave that what he had sure looked like leish. Dave sent me an email. "Have you considered the possibility of leishmaniasis? It can be a serious thing. I'm pretty sure that's what I have at this point. I'm investigating the situation right now." I immediately Googled the disease and read about it with fascination and disgust. The images of leish in the early stages did indeed look like my bug bite. The pictures also showed me what it could develop into, and that was a perfect horror. Leishmaniasis is the 2nd deadliest parasitic disease in the world, behind only malaria, and it affects 12 million people worldwide, with around 1 or 2 million new cases every year. It kills 60,000 people a year. Of the leading neglected tropical diseases in the world, NTDs, leishmaniasis is one of the most prominent, if not number 1. But because it almost always affects poor people in rural areas of the tropics, there's little economic incentive for pharmaceutical companies to develop vaccines or treatments. Meanwhile, Bill Benenson and Steve began circulating emails to the entire group, asking if anyone else had bug bites that weren't going away. Mark Adams, the sound engineer, reported he had a lesion on his knee. Tom Weinberg had a suspicious ulcer on his knuckle. Mark Plotkin had an unexplained rash. Sully and Woody both had bug bites that were turning into sores. A few days later, this was in late April 2015, fed up with his local doctors and the Italian ER, Dave went to the largest hospital in Rome and demanded to see a tropical disease specialist there. At the beginning of the examination, when Dave opined that it was leash, the doctor snapped, "No, it isn't." But by the end of the examination, the doctor agreed that he did indeed appear to have the disease. He suggested Dave return to the States for a more precise diagnosis, since leash is notoriously difficult to identify. It is not a single disease, but a suite of diseases caused by some 30 different parasitic species carried by several dozen kinds of sandflies. On May 2, 2015, Dave sent an email to the group in which he reported on his visit to the tropical disease doctor in Rome and offered some advice. Brothers in the leash, despite the fact nobody from the group has been diagnosed with anything, I'm going to perhaps jump the gun and address one elephant in the room directly. There may be cause to explore the possibility of leishmaniasis in my case, and as I understand the situation, possibly others from the group. He said he had decided to return to the States for a firm diagnosis and treatment. This set off a minor panic. Dozens of messages circulated among the expedition members discussing symptoms, real and imagined. Even those without evident signs of leash rushed to their doctors, worried about various complaints, rashes, fevers, headaches, and other ailments. Stomach-turning photographs of everyone's expanding ulcers were circulated and circulated again. Steve Elkins remained exasperatingly healthy. But Bill Benenson had discovered two jungle ticks on himself when he returned to California. While that had not led to anything serious, he was shaken up, and he was very concerned about what was happening to others. He sent out an email. "I feel we should all share our relevant medical information together, if possible and comfortable, to help ourselves and for all future explorers as well. Let's remember, we've not only made history together in February, but that we're still discovering a great deal that's new and exciting about a lost place in a very threatened environment." I was now thoroughly alarmed about my own sore. Steve Elkins dug up the name of a tropical disease specialist in New Mexico who might be able to help me, Dr. Ravi Durvasula at the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Albuquerque. Dr. Durvasula was a specialist in old-world leishmaniasis. I called the VA hospital, hoping to speak to him. An hour later, after multiple phone calls and a mind-boggling number of transfers from one wrong office to another, after being told that no such doctor existed, that the doctor worked there but didn't take patients, that I wasn't allowed to speak to his office without a referral, and that the doctor did not take referrals, I gave up. I can't imagine how our wounded soldiers negotiate the same telephone system. "Forget about calling the VA," Steve said to me. "Send him an email. Be sure to play up the whole expedition thing, the lost city, National Geographic, all that sexy stuff." So I did. "Dear Dr. Durvasula, I am a journalist for National Geographic magazine and The New Yorker. I recently returned from an expedition into an extremely remote area in the La Mosquitia rainforest, exploring a large unknown pre-Columbian ruin. We were in the jungle from February 17th through the 26th. Since that time, four members of the expedition have become ill with the same symptoms. I live in New Mexico, and I had heard you were a specialist in leishmaniasis, and that is why I'm contacting you to see if you might be willing to take my case." Dr. Durvasula emailed me back immediately. He couldn't have been more helpful and concerned, in contrast to the VA staff. We arranged a phone call, and he asked me some questions. "Does the area have a whitish, pearlescent appearance, surrounded by red?" "Yes." "Does it itch, No. Does it hurt or feel sore at all? No. No discomfort? None at all. Ah, well, I am afraid those are the classic signs of leishmaniasis. He asked me to email him a photo. When he got it, he confirmed it certainly appeared to be leish. He suggested I seek help at the National Institutes of Health, NIH, the best place in the world, he said, for leishmaniasis study and treatment. In the meantime, Dave Yoder explored treatment options in the States. He, too, zeroed in on the National Institutes of Health and contacted them. At the NIH, Dave reached Dr. Thomas Nutman, deputy chief of the Laboratory of Parasitic Diseases. Nutman was fascinated by the story of the expedition to the Lost City and the mass outbreak of disease. He wrote Dave, "Dear Dave, I think there is a very high likelihood that this is leishmania, and because of the strains in Honduras, there is a small but real chance that this could turn into mucocutaneous disease, depending on the strain. The big issue is defining which strain of leishmania you have and tailoring treatment to that particular strain. We have taken care of a number of National Geographic folks in the past." The National Institutes of Health's overall mission is to seek fundamental knowledge about the nature and behavior of living systems, and then leverage that knowledge to enhance health, lengthen life, and reduce illness and disability. It is strictly a research institution, and anyone admitted for treatment must be part of a research study. Each of its projects has a set of rules that outline who can be treated, why, and how their treatment will contribute to medical knowledge. If a potential patient meets the criteria and is enrolled, the care is free. It even includes financial help with transportation and lodging. In return, the patient agrees to follow the rules and donate to medical research any tissue samples, cells, blood, parasites, and so forth. A participant can withdraw at any time for any reason. The NIH doctors were keenly interested in our situation. The mass outbreak of disease was unusual. The valley of T1 seemed extraordinarily hot, and the region was unknown medically, all of which made the expedition an enticing medical study. The doctors offered to treat us all for free. It was nice to be wanted. In late May, Dave flew from Rome to Washington for a firm diagnosis. "Hopefully," he joked, "we'll all turn up negative and it'll turn out to be a minor staph infection from Woody's jungle stew that is easily treated with an application of cayenne sauce." The doctor in charge of the project who would be treating Dave, me, and the other potential brothers in the leash was Theodore Nash, principal investigator in the Clinical Parasitology Section, Laboratory of Parasitic Diseases, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Nash was one of the country's leading experts in leishmaniasis treatment, having worked under Dr. Frank Neva, a pioneer in leishmaniasis treatment, who came to the NIH from Harvard. After Neva's retirement, Nash became the chief clinical researcher into leish at the NIH, and over the past decades, he advanced its treatment with new drugs and formulations. At NIH, doctors took a biopsy of Dave's lesion, looked at it under a microscope, and saw it was teeming with round microscopic leishmania parasites. But Dave's treatment would depend on what kind of leish it was. A special lab at NIH began the process of sequencing the parasite's DNA. Leishmaniasis has a long and terrible history with human beings, stretching back as far as human records exist and causing suffering and death for thousands of years. A few years ago, 100-million-year-old piece of Burmese amber was found to have trapped a sandfly that had sucked the blood of a reptile, most likely a dinosaur. Inside this sandfly, scientists discovered leishmania parasites, and in its proboscis, or sucking tube, they found reptilian blood cells infected with the same parasites. Even dinosaurs got leishmaniasis. Leishmania has probably been around since the final breakup of the primordial continent known as Pangaea. As these ancient landmasses eventually drifted apart to become the old and new worlds, the populations of that sandfly ancestor were separated and continued to evolve independently, eventually giving rise to the two basic strains of the disease in the old world and the new. At some point, the disease made the leap from reptiles to mammals. Modern reptiles still get leish, and there has been a medical debate over whether reptilian leish can be transmitted to humans. The answer is probably not. Unlike many diseases that afflict human beings, leish was global from the very outset, and it was dreaded by our ancient ancestors in both hemispheres. Archaeologists have found leish parasites in Egyptian mummies dating back 5,000 years and in Peruvian mummies going back 3,000 years. A description of leish appears in one of the earliest written human documents, the cuneiform tablets of King Ashurbanipal, who ruled the Assyrian Empire 2,700 years ago. Leishmaniasis comes in three varieties, each with distinct symptoms. The most common form is cutaneous, i.e. skin, leishmaniasis, which is found in many parts of the Old World, especially Africa, India, and the Middle East. It is also widespread in Mexico and Central and South America, and it recently popped up in Texas and Oklahoma. Some U.S. troops returning from Iraq and Afghanistan contracted cutaneous leish during their deployments and nicknamed it the Baghdad Boil. This kind of leish starts as a sore at the bottom of the bite, which grows into a weeping lesion. If left alone, it usually goes away, leaving only an ugly scar. It can usually be treated by burning, freezing, or the surgical removal of the ulcer. In visceral leishmaniasis, the second type, also from the Old World, the parasite invades the body's internal organs, particularly the liver, spleen, and bone marrow. It is sometimes known as black fever because it often turns its victim's skin black. This variety is deadly. Without treatment, it is always fatal. But treatment of visceral leish is quick and reliable, requiring a single infusion of an antibiotic drug that yields a cure rate of about 95%. Most of the deaths in the world from leish are caused by the visceral form, among poor children who don't have access to treatment. The final form of leish is the mucocutaneous or mucosal variety, the major New World form of the disease. It starts as a skin sore like the cutaneous kind. Months or years later, the sores can reappear in the mucous membranes of the nose and mouth. The sores I had in my mouth, however, were probably unrelated. When leish moves to your face, the disease gets serious. The ulcers grow, eating away the nose and lips from the inside, and eventually causing them to slough off, leaving the face horrifically disfigured. The parasite continues to devour the bones of the face, the upper jaw, and teeth. This form of leish, while not always lethal, is the most difficult to treat, and the treatment itself involves a drug that has toxic and sometimes fatal side effects. The pre-Columbian inhabitants of South America were plagued by mucosal leish, which they called uta. The grotesque disfigurement of the face terrified the Moche, Inca, and other ancient cultures. They may have considered it a punishment or a curse from the gods. Archaeologists have uncovered burials in Peru and elsewhere of people whose disease was so advanced that they had a caved-in hole where the face used to be. The disease had eaten away everything, including the facial bones. Ancient Peruvian pots so faithfully record the disfigurations that researchers can identify in them the actual clinical stages of the disease, from the early soft tissue destruction of the nose to the general destruction of the nose and lips, and finally to the disintegration of the hard palate, nasal septum, upper jaw, and teeth, The Peruvian custom of punishing people by mutilating the nose and lips may have been intended to imitate the facial deformities caused by the disease, perhaps to mimic what they believed was divine retribution. Acute fear of the disease may have even driven human settlement patterns in South America. The archaeologist James Kuss, a retired professor at California State University, Fresno, believes that the Inca site of Machu Picchu may have been chosen in part because of the prevalence of mucosal leish. The Incas were paranoid about leishmaniasis, he told me. The sandfly that transmits leish can't live at higher altitudes, but it is widespread in the lowland areas where the Inca grew coca, a sacred crop. Machu Picchu lies at just the right altitude, too high for leish, but not too high for coca. At Machu Picchu, the king and his court could rule from a place of safety and preside over the rituals associated with coca cultivation without the risk of getting this most dreaded disease. When the Spanish conquistadors arrived in South America in the 16th century, they were horrified at the facial deformities they saw among native people in the lowlands of the Andes, especially among the coca growers. The Spanish thought they were looking at a form of leprosy and called the disease lepra blanca, white leprosy. Over the years, mucosal leish has acquired many nicknames in Latin America: taper nose, hoarse voice, spongy wound, big canker. Mucosal leish didn't exist in the Old World, but the even deadlier visceral form, the kind that invades the internal organs, had long plagued the Indian subcontinent. It first gained the attention of Western medicine as the British extended their empire into India. 18th century writers described it as Kala Azar, or black fever. Visceral leish easily spreads from person to person via the bite of sandflies, using human beings as its primary reservoir host. It was so deadly and spread so fast that in certain regions of India in the 19th century, leishmaniasis would sweep through an area, killing everyone and leaving a landscape of empty villages, entirely bereft of human life. The British also noted the cutaneous form of the disease in India and the Near East and gave it various names: Aleppo Evil, Jericho Button, Delhi Boil, Oriental Sore. But doctors did not recognize a connection between the two strains until 1901. William Boog Leishman, a doctor from Glasgow who was a general in the British Army, was posted in the town of Dum Dum near Calcutta, where one of his soldiers fell ill with a fever and a swollen spleen. After the man died, Leishman looked at thin sections of the man's spleen under the microscope and, using a new staining method, discovered tiny round bodies in the cells, the Leishmania parasite. Leishman called it Dum Dum fever. A few weeks after Leishman published his discovery, another British doctor named Charles Donovan, also stationed in India, independently reported the results of his own research. He, too, had spied the offending parasite, and between the two of them, the disease leishmaniasis was identified. Leishman got the dubious honor of having the disease named after him, while Donovan was gifted with the species name, Leishmania donovani. Doctors figured out in 1911 that it was transmitted by the sandfly, and later they realized that a bewildering number of mammals could be reservoir hosts for the disease, including dogs, cats, rats, mice, gerbils, hamsters, jackals, opossums, foxes, monk seals, and of course, humans. This astonishingly broad range of host animals makes it one of the most successful diseases on the planet. I was still trying to decide whether I should go to NIH or not when the DNA analysis of Dave's parasites came back. It showed he was infected with a species of leish parasite known as Leishmania brasiliensis. This was bad news for Dave and the rest of us, because L. brasiliensis causes the third mucosal variety of the disease and is considered to be one of the most difficult of all to cure. Dr. Nash decided to begin Dave's treatment immediately. He would use a drug called amphotericin B, administered by slow infusion. Doctors have nicknamed the drug amphoterrible because of its nasty side effects. It is considered a last resort, most commonly given to patients with fungal infections of the blood when other drugs have failed. Most of these patients are extremely ill with AIDS. Dr. Nash would give Dave and the rest of us a formulation of the drug called liposomal amphotericin. In this form, the toxic drug is encapsulated in microscopic spherules made of lipids, fats. This makes the drug safer, reducing some of the most dangerous side effects. But the lipid droplets can cause disturbing side effects of their own. The length of treatment depends on how well the patient tolerates the drug and how quickly the ulcer begins to heal. The ideal course, which Dr. Nash had determined over many years of experience, was 7 days, long enough to halt the disease, but not so long as to harm the patient. Shortly after Dave was diagnosed with Leish, Tom Weinberg learned from the CDC that he too had the disease. Chris Fisher, Mark Adams, and Juan Carlos Fernandez went to the NIH and were also diagnosed with it. All were treated except Juan Carlos. Dr. Nash recognized that his immune system appeared to be fighting it off and decided to delay treatment. It was the right decision, and Juan Carlos ended up Leish-free without going through the rigors of amphotericin B. From the UK, we heard that Woody had contracted Leish, as had Sully, despite bundling themselves up so scrupulously every evening. Sully was going to be treated at the Royal Center for Defense Medicine at Birmingham Heartlands Hospital, while Woody was starting treatment at the Hospital for Tropical Diseases in London. Both would get a new drug, miltefosine. Word soon came back from Honduras that many Honduran members of the expedition had also fallen ill with leishmaniasis. These included Oscar Neal, the archaeologist, the commanding officer of the military contingent, Lieutenant Colonel Osiguera, and 9 soldiers. When the news of our mini-epidemic began to spread among members of the expedition, accompanied by gruesome photos of weeping ulcers, it was hard not to think about the centuries-old legend and its oft-cited curse of the monkey god. All those flowers we chopped down. Gallows humor aside, though, many of us were privately aghast at having walked so blithely into that hot zone, at having congratulated ourselves prematurely for emerging from the jungle unscathed. The jokes petered out quickly in the face of this dramatic disease, which had the potential to alter the course of each of our lives. Things had begun to feel deadly serious. Because amphotericin is expensive and not available in Honduras, the Honduran members of the expedition were being treated with an older drug, a pentavalent antimonial compound. Antimony, a heavy metal, is directly below arsenic in the periodic table of elements and is similarly poisonous. This drug kills the parasite while sparing, one hopes, the patient. As bad as Ampho-B is, this one is worse. Even in the best scenarios, it has dreadful side effects. We heard from Virgilio that Oscar, who had been bitten on the right side of his face, had almost died of the treatment and was recovering in seclusion in Mexico. He would have a nasty scar for life. He later grew a beard to cover it up and declined to speak of his experience or do any further work at T1. After Dave was diagnosed with mucosal Leish, I finally understood that I had to stop procrastinating and get treated. As bad as the treatment sounded, I wasn't willing to take a chance with the disease itself or with my face. So, finally at the end of May, I called the NIH and set up an appointment for early June to get a biopsy and diagnosis. By this time, My bug bite had turned into an oozing crater the size of a quarter, fiery red and disgusting to look at. It didn't bother me. I'd had no more fevers, and I felt fine. Dr. Nash said he doubted my fevers had been caused by the leash anyway. They were, he thought, coincidental viral infections, perhaps opportunistic because my immune system had been shaken up by leash, which hijacks white blood cells. As my date approached, I heard that Dave's treatment with liposomal amphotericin had gone very badly. He had suffered serious kidney damage, and Dr. Nash had halted it after only 2 infusions. He remained hospitalized at the NIH under observation while the doctors debated what to do next. Chapter 24. My head felt like it was in flames. The National Institutes of Health occupies a verdant campus of several hundred acres in Bethesda, Maryland. I arrived alone on June 1st, a gorgeous summer day, the smell of freshly cut grass drifting in the air, birdsong pouring from the trees. Sandals and jeans seemed to outnumber lab coats, and the place had the relaxed air of a college. As I walked up the drive toward the clinical center complex, I could hear from far away a lone bugler playing taps. I entered the center, and after wandering around more lost than I'd ever been in the jungle, I managed to find the patient processing area. There I signed paperwork, agreeing to be studied, and a kindly nurse took 13 vials of my blood. I met Dr. Ted Nash and my second doctor, Elise O'Connell, and was reassured by their warmth and professionalism. In the dermatology lab, a photographer arrived with a Canon digital camera. He affixed a little ruler just below the ulcer on my arm and took dozens of photographs. I was ushered into an examination room where the lesion was inspected by a gaggle of earnest medical students who took turns peering, palpating, and asking questions. Next, in the biopsy lab, a nurse cut 2 worm-like plugs of flesh out of the lesion, and the holes were stitched up. When the biopsy came back, it would offer no surprise. Like Dave and everyone else, I had Leishmania brasiliensis. Or at least that's what the doctors initially believed. Our primary doctor, Theodore Nash, was 71 years old. He did his rounds in a white lab coat with a roll of papers precariously shoved into a side pocket. He had curly salt-and-pepper hair, brushed back from a domed forehead, steel-rimmed spectacles, and the kindly, distracted air of a professor. Even though, like most doctors, he was fantastically busy, his manner was unhurried and relaxed, and he was gregarious and happy to answer questions at length. I said I wanted to hear the straight story without any window dressing. He said that was how he preferred to work with all his patients. He was refreshingly, even alarmingly, direct. The National Institutes of Health has been conducting clinical studies on leishmaniasis since the early 1970s, treating recent immigrants and people who had picked up the disease while traveling. Many of the patients were Peace Corps volunteers. Dr. Nash participated in the treatment of most of them. He had written the upgraded leishmaniasis treatment protocol for the NIH in 2001, and it is still in use today. He shifted treatment away from the antimonial drug, which he thought was too toxic, to amphotericin and other drugs, depending on the parasite species and the geographic variety. Nash knew as much about leish treatment as any doctor in the United States. This is not a simple disease, and treatment is more an art than a science. The clinical data isn't deep enough to give doctors a precise formula, and there are too many forms of leish and many unknowns. Dr. Nash had spent almost his entire medical career in the parasitology section of the NIH, 45 years, going back, he said, to the time when parasitology was the backwater of science. No one was interested, and no one would work with you. Because most people who get parasites are poor, and because infectious disease medicine is not usually fee-based, parasitology is one of the lower paying of all the medical specialties. To go into the field, you have to truly care about helping people. Your extremely expensive 10-year medical education gives you the privilege of working long hours for modest pay among the poorest and most vulnerable people in the world, encountering a staggering amount of misery and death. Your reward is to relieve a small bit of that suffering. It takes a rare kind of human being to become a parasitologist. Nash's early research focused on schistosomiasis and then giardia, a common worldwide waterborne parasite. Today, the main focus of his work is a parasitic disease called neurocysticercosis, in which the brain is invaded by tapeworm larvae that originate in undercooked pork. The larvae circulate in the bloodstream, and some get stuck in the tiny vessels in the brain, where they form cysts, leaving the brain peppered with grape-sized, fluid-filled holes. The brain becomes inflamed, and the victim suffers seizures, hallucinations, memory failure, and death. Neurocysticercosis affects millions of people and is the world's leading cause of acquired epileptic seizures. If only we had the smallest fraction of the money that is devoted to malaria, he declared to me in anguish, we could do so much to stop this disease. In our first meeting, Nash sat me down and explained why he thought our team had become infected, how leishmaniasis works, what its life cycle is, and what I had to expect from treatment. The disease requires two animals, a reservoir host, an infected mammal whose blood is teeming with the parasite, and a vector, which is the female sandfly. When the sandfly bites a host and sucks its blood, it also draws in parasites. Those parasites proliferate in the sandfly's gut until it bites another host. The parasites are then injected into the new host, where they complete their life cycle. Each host animal lives out its life as a typhoid Mary, infecting the sandflies that drink its blood. The parasite, while it can devastate a human being, generally does not cost the host animal very much, although some host mammals get lesions on their noses. A good guest does not burn down the house he's staying in. Leishmania wants its host animal to live long and prosper, spreading as much disease as possible. In the isolated valley of T1, far removed from human habitation, sandflies, and an as-yet unknown mammalian host, it could be mice, rats, capybaras, tapirs, peccaries, or even monkeys, had been locked in a cycle of infection and reinfection going on for centuries. And then, said Nash, you intruded. You were a mistake. By invading the valley, we were like clueless civilians wandering onto a battlefield and getting shot to pieces in the crossfire. When an infected sandfly bites a person, the fly unleashes hundreds to thousands of parasites into the person's tissue. These tiny single-celled animals have flagella so they can swim around. They are small. It would take about 30 to span a human hair. But they are positively gargantuan compared to bacteria and viruses that cause disease. Almost 1 billion cold viruses, for example, could be packed into a single Leishmania parasite. Because it is a complex, single-celled animal, its methods are more subtle and devious than a virus or bacterium. When a sandfly injects Leishmania, the human body, sensing the intrusion, sends an army of white blood cells to hunt down, swallow, and destroy the parasites. White blood cells, which come in many types, usually deal with bacteria and other foreign bodies by engulfing and digesting them. Unfortunately, this is exactly what the Leishmania parasite wants, to be swallowed. Once inside the white blood cell, the parasite drops its flagellum, becomes egg-shaped, and starts to multiply. Soon the white blood cell is bulging with parasites like an overstuffed beanbag, and it bursts, releasing the parasites into the victim's tissues. More white blood cells rush to attack and engulf the loose parasites, and they are in turn hijacked into producing more parasites. The ulcer that forms around the infected area isn't caused by the parasite per se, but by the body's immune system attacking it. The inflammation, not the parasite, is what eats away the person's skin and, in the mucosal form, destroys the face. The immune system goes nuts trying to get rid of the parasite that is blowing up its white blood cells, and this fight trashes the battlefield, inflaming and killing the tissues in the bite area. As the parasite slowly spreads, the lesion expands, destroying the skin and leaving a crater exposing the raw flesh below. The ulcer is usually painless. Nobody knows why, unless it occurs over joints when the pain can be intense. Most deaths from mucosal leash occur from infections invading the body through this unprotected doorway. Nash then talked about the drug that I would be taking, amphotericin. He said it was the gold standard, the drug of choice for this kind of leash. While miltefosine was a newer drug and could be taken in pill form, he didn't want to use it. And besides, there was none available. There had been too few clinical trials to make him comfortable with it, and in one trial in Colombia, it seemed to be ineffective against L. brasilianus. He also said you never really knew what kind of side effects might pop up until at least 10,000 people had taken a drug, and miltefosine had not reached that benchmark. He had had long experience with amphotericin B, and it produced an approximately 85% cure rate, which was about as good as it gets in any drug treatment. The drug works by binding to the parasite's cell membrane and tearing open a tiny hole in it, causing the organism to leak and die. Nash told me what I might experience in taking the drug. He didn't sugarcoat his comments. The side effects of liposomal amphotericin, he said, can be dramatic and are almost too numerous to mention. There are acute reactions that occur instantly upon receiving the drug, and there are dangerous long-term side effects that occur days later. Many of these side effects are complex and poorly understood. When he started using it around 15 years ago, things went well at first, and then, all of a sudden, his patients began to experience acute reactions when the drug went into the body. It turns out that some people tolerate the drug and some don't. These reactions, he said, initially panicked him because they mimicked symptoms of an acute infection. Fever, chills, pain, soaring heart rate, chest pressure, and difficulty breathing. On top of that, the drug had a mysterious psychological effect on a few patients. Within seconds of receiving the drug, they became overwhelmed by a feeling of impending doom that, in the worst cases, made them believe they were actually dying. In those, he had to halt the infusion and sometimes administer a narcotic to calm down or knock out the patient. That acute reaction, however, usually went away quickly, and Nash emphasized that many patients experienced no reaction at all. I might be one of the lucky ones. He reeled off other common side effects: nausea, vomiting, anorexia, dizziness, headache, insomnia, skin rash, fever, shaking, chills, and mental confusion. Other physical effects include electrolyte imbalances, decreases in white blood cell count, and liver function abnormalities. These outcomes were so frequent, he explained, that I could expect to get at least some of them. But the most common and dangerous side effect is that the drug damages the kidneys, degrading renal function. The harm tends to be worse the older you are. Old people, he said, lose renal function naturally as they age. I asked Nash if I was, at 58, in the old category, and he thought that was funny. "Oh," he cried, "so you're still telling yourself you're middle-aged?" "Yes, we all go through that period of denial." As a general rule of thumb, he would stop administering the drug when kidney function had dropped to 40% of baseline. The whole process, he said, is stressful for the patient and stressful for the doctor. When I asked him if the disease was curable, he hemmed and hawed a bit. It's curable in the sense that the symptoms go away. But it's not curable in the sense that the body is completely rid of the parasite. What doctors call a sterile cure. Like chickenpox, which can come back years later as shingles, the parasite hides in the body. The point of the treatment is to beat down the parasite enough to allow the body's immune system to take over and keep it in check. Rather than mounting a frontal attack on the body, a Pickett's charge, the parasite hides and shifts about, sniping from cover. But white blood cells talk to each other using chemicals called cytokines. The cytokines tweak how white blood cells respond to a leishmania attack, eventually training them to mount a better defense. But the mucosal and visceral forms of the disease can come roaring back if your immune system goes downhill. That can happen, for example, if you get HIV or undergo cancer treatment or an organ transplant. In L. brasiliensis, recurrences of the disease are not uncommon even in people with good immune systems. But even in the best case scenario, your body must engage in low-level warfare with the parasite for the rest of your life. While I was in the hospital for my biopsy, I visited Dave, who was recovering from his aborted treatment. He was installed in a large private room with a fine view of rooftops, trees, and lawns. Eager to see him for the first time since we left the jungle, I found him sitting on the side of the bed, dressed in a hospital gown. Even though I knew he'd been through hell, his appearance was a shock. Dave looked shattered, a far cry from the robust, sardonic professional who, festooned with cameras and cracking jokes, had a few months earlier tramped around the jungle in the pouring rain, shoving lenses in our faces. But he managed to greet me with a wan smile and a sweaty handshake, not rising from the bed, and told me what had happened. Because amphotericin damages the kidneys, before starting him on the drug, Nash and his team had analyzed Dave's kidney renal function and decided it was not as strong as they would like. They checked him into the hospital for the duration of the treatment so that his renal function could be closely watched. There is a substance in the blood called creatinine, a waste product of muscle use, which the kidneys filter out at a regular rate. When creatinine levels rise, it means the kidneys are not functioning properly. By checking creatinine levels daily, the doctors at NIH can monitor how much kidney damage is taking place. In the early stages, such damage is almost always reversible. Dave then described what it was like to get the drug, which echoed many of Nash's warnings. The total process, he said, took 7 to 8 hours. After the nurses settled him comfortably into a lounge chair and attached an IV, they conducted a battery of blood tests to make sure his numbers were good. Then they ran a liter of saline solution into his body, diluting his blood so that the kidneys would be able to flush the drug through quickly. The saline drip took an hour, followed by a 15-minute infusion of Benadryl to tamp down any allergic reaction he might have to the amphotericin. Meanwhile, the nurses hung an evil-looking opaque brown bag, which contained the liposomal amphotericin. When all is ready, Dave said, they turn a valve that starts the amphotericin. The liquid is expected to spend 3 or 4 hours creeping out of the bag and into the patient's arm. "So what happened when you got the drug?" I asked. I watched that limoncello-colored solution come down through the tubes and go into me, Dave said. And within seconds of it entering my veins, I felt a big pressure on my chest and a pain in my back. I felt this profound tightness in my chest with really difficult breathing, and my head felt like it was in flames. Dr. Nash had immediately stopped the flow of the drug. These were, in fact, common side effects of starting the infusion, caused not by the amphotericin itself, but by the tiny lipid droplets that, for mysterious reasons, sometimes fool the body into thinking a gigantic foreign cellular invasion is taking place. The symptoms usually go away fairly quickly. In Dave's case, the doctors let him recuperate for a few hours, and then pumped him full of more antihistamines and started him on the amphotericin again, at a slower rate. This time he made it through. They gave him a second infusion the following day. But late that evening, Dr. Nash came in with bad news. "You flunked amphotericin." Dave's creatinine levels had soared. His kidneys had taken a serious hit. The doctors had decided to halt the treatment for good. They were going to keep him there, he said, for the rest of the week, monitoring his renal function to make sure he was properly recovering. "So what now?" I asked. "How are you going to get cured?" He shook his head. "Fuck if I know." He said the doctors were going to wait and see if the two doses had knocked out the leash, which was possible, but unlikely. It was a slow-acting disease, and there was no need to rush into another potentially toxic treatment. In the meantime, the NIH would try to get the newer drug, miltefosine, for him. A course of miltefosine can cost close to $20,000, compared to around $6,000 or $8,000 for Ampho-B. Even though miltefosine was unavailable in the States, Dr. Nash was going to see if it could be brought in under a special permit as an experimental treatment. I had been listening to all this with rising dismay, realizing that I had no alternative but to take the same journey myself. My own treatment was scheduled for the end of the month. Chapter 25. They Try to Have Tea with Your Immune System. On June 22nd, I returned to the National Institutes of Health. In the interim, Chris Fisher had also been through the treatment, while most of the others were scheduled after me. His initial reaction to the drug had been as bad as Dave's. Sudden pain, a feeling of pressure and suffocation, and a panicked feeling that he might be dying. But luckily, those side effects went away in less than 10 minutes. Chris's body had tolerated the amphotericin better than Dave's, and he managed to get the full 7-day course. Even so, he had a rough time. The treatment left him feeling nauseous, exhausted, beaten up, and totally without ambition. After he returned to Colorado, he got a rash on his body so terrible that the NIH doctors wanted to hospitalize him. He refused. He was sick all summer and unable to work into the fall semester, which caused him professional difficulties with his university department. The leash ulcer then started to come back, and only went away after Chris applied heat treatments to it. Over a year later, Chris's rash still hadn't completely healed. Dave and Chris's experiences were in the forefront of my thoughts as I filled out the usual paperwork at the NIH. My wife, Christine, had come with me, and we were escorted into one of the hospital rooms used for infusions. It was a very pleasant space, although the furniture was bizarrely oversized. I felt like I'd landed in Swift's imaginary kingdom of Brobdingnag. The nurse explained that the NIH was researching morbid obesity, and we were in one of the rooms specially built for those patients. I took my seat in the infusion chair, stressed and anxious. Since the infusions took a total of 6 to 8 hours a day for 7 days, I had brought a backpack stuffed with 20 pounds of my favorite comfort books, far more than I could ever read. Edgar Allan Poe, Arthur Conan Doyle, Wilkie Collins. I imagined being trapped for hours with a terrifying Nurse Ratched hovering about. But a perverse part of me was also curious about the effects of the drug. What would it be like to believe I was dying? Maybe I'd see the face of God, or the light at the end of the tunnel, or the flying spaghetti monster. An agreeable, totally unratched nurse arrived, inserted the IV and drew blood, then she started me on the saline drip. My actual ulcer would not be messed with, although they would examine it every day to see if it began to heal. The blood work came back an hour later, and all was good. I had strong kidney function. With both Drs. Nash and O'Connell in watchful attendance, the evil brown bag of amphotericin B was hung on the IV rack next to a bag of Benadryl. 15 minutes of a Benadryl infusion left me feeling groggy, and then the stopcock was turned and the ampho started down the tubes. Dave, our honorary Italian, had compared it to limoncello. To me, it looked like the color of urine. Watching it creep down the tube toward my vein only raised my anxiety levels, so I forced myself to avert my eyes. I chatted with the doctors and my wife, pretending nothing was happening, but all the while bracing myself for the sudden pain, the pressure, my head erupting in flames, God or Baal. I could see my two doctors were also chatting about nothing with excessive cheer, trying to cover up their own nervousness. The yellow liquid went in, and then nothing happened. I experienced none of the side effects that Dave and Chris did. It was a total anticlimax. Everyone was relieved, but I was also slightly disappointed. From there, my treatment proceeded uneventfully. I arrived at the clinical center every morning around 8, got stuck with an IV, was subjected to a battery of blood tests, and then infused. After the third day, I asked my doctors to stop the Benadryl, aimed at blocking an allergic reaction to the drug, because it made me sleepy. They did so with no problems. After a few days, the inevitable nasty side effects of the ampho did begin to creep in. I got a persistent headache and started to feel nauseated. Beyond that, I had a vague mental uneasiness that something was going badly wrong inside me, but I couldn't put my finger on what. The side effects worsened until the sixth day, when I felt I was dragging around the world's worst hangover: headache, nausea, lethargy, and muddled thinking. Toward the end of my treatment, Mark Adams, the sound engineer, started his. Mark had been on both expeditions, the 2012 LIDAR search and the 2015 jungle foray. He had been one of my favorite people, soft-spoken and cheerful, even when hauling 40 pounds of sound equipment and a long boom mic through dense jungle in the pouring rain. We asked to be together in the same room, where we passed the time chatting and reminiscing about our adventures. Mark also tolerated the ampho well, experiencing none of the scary side effects. Awful as I felt, the nausea and apathy were among the most common and mildest side effects of amphotericin. I was extremely lucky. My doctors gave me anti-nausea drugs, ibuprofen, and a vile-tasting drink to restore my electrolyte balance. But on the sixth day, Nash and O'Connell told me my kidney function had dropped into the danger zone and they were going to discontinue the infusions. They wanted me to wait and have the final infusion after my kidneys had recovered. I received that infusion a few weeks later, closer to home, arranged by the NIH and my brother David, who is a doctor. The hangover went away after about a week of the initial round, and in the following months, the lesion dried up, flattened out, and turned into a shiny scar. At one point, I asked Dr. Nash about the risks of going back into the jungle, which, despite everything, part of me remained eager to do if I could. He said the research indicated that 75 to 85% of people who got leash were thereafter immune. He felt I should be much more concerned about other diseases rife in the area for which there are no preventatives: dengue fever, chikungunya, and Chagas disease. At this point, Zika had not yet arrived in Honduras. I returned to the NIH 3 months later, in September 2015, for a follow-up. Nash and O'Connell looked me over, poked at the scar, took some blood, and concluded that the disease had been drubbed into remission. I was cured, at least as far as was possible. While neither doctor could talk about the other members of the expedition due to medical confidentiality, I did learn that I was one of the lucky ones, and that some of my fellow travelers, who have asked me not to identify them,